Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Baltimore police turn over a report on Freddie Gray's death to the state prosecutor, but not to the public. The Supreme Court hears arguments on same-sex marriage and lethal injections. And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says he'll run for president as a Democrat. Joining me for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Nina Totenberg of NPR, Neil King of The Wall Street Journal, and John Dickerson of Slate and CBS News. And for the first time since he's returned to our News Roundup, he's also been named as the new host of Face the Nation on CBS, succeeding our great friend Bob Schieffer. His first show will be on June 7th. Welcome back, John.
Thank you.
You can see John, Nina, and Neil if you watch live streaming of the Friday News Roundup this hour. Just go to our website, drshow.org. And later you can join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, I think we have to start with the situation in Baltimore. John, bring us up to date on the latest that's happening there.
Well, the latest is happening is that the rioting from earlier in the week has died down. We've got this report that's going into prosecutors. The question is still unanswered. What happened in those fateful moments with Freddie Gray between when he was arrested and then when he died, or when he was in this half an hour, and there have been some reports that seem to be focusing, news reports, this is not official, but they are based on this investigation, that it appears that his injuries were sustained during the car ride, during the van ride with the police. There was a piece earlier in the week by the Baltimore Sun about the so-called rough rides in which those who were picked up by the police were left to be in the back of vans, handcuffed but not restrained, and then during the course of the ride were basically abused by the way in which the van was driven. And so a lot of people are making this connection between the leaked information that may be in the investigation and the injuries being sustained by this ride in the van.
There are so many questions about this that we just don't have answers yet for, Nina. And the police did turn over their report to state prosecutors yesterday, a day early. They didn't release it to the public. Is that customary?
It is, because you're still in the middle of the investigation. They've done a very fast investigation, but prosecutors can ask for more, will undoubtedly ask for more. If you watch Law and Order, they even do some of their own work, and they do. And so you wouldn't want to release something that was completely misleading, either implicating somebody or not implicating somebody, and you need more evidence. You're still gathering evidence. So this is fairly typical, although it goes against all of the instincts of every reporter and every member of the public here, who we all want to know what happened.
It also makes you liable to leaks, which are sometimes wrong and are almost always at least incomplete, Neil.
Well, there have been some, we don't know whether there were leaks, I guess they were. There was the talk that one of the other people that was in the van, they had actually stopped at one point and picked up another suspect and some other thing, and he was not able to see Freddie Gray, but was had come out with some story that he might have done whatever harm to himself by thrashing around in the van. The word then came out, though I think it was actually put forward by the prosecutor's office, that the van had made an extra stop that was not known previously. It's a very curious ride.
Which is in and of itself a very weird thing.
It is, yeah.
The authorities wouldn't have known about another stop.
Yeah, which they found out from a private camera of some kind. I mean, this is obviously a very incendiary scene, very tense scene in Baltimore. I think there's a lot of concern that they both be seen as being swift, but that the timing be right and whenever they come out with the report, because there's a lot that can be triggered there. And it was an extraordinary thing that we watched play out in a major American city. Buildings, whole apartment houses or a senior center in this case being in flames. The fact that they closed down a baseball game and they played it in private, which was an amazing moment. We were talking about it earlier, but you think of after 9/11, we went forward and played baseball, and in Paris after the Charlie Hebdo killings, they had mass demonstrations and big walks in the city of Paris. You just wonder. I'm still sort of struck that we've seen these protests and this violence, but we haven't really still yet seen the kind of galvanizing of the public in a way that would be some wider overt demonstration of concern about what it is that we're witnessing. And in the case of Baltimore, this is unlike the case in Ferguson or what we saw with the Walter Scott shooting in North Charleston. This is really putting a very close lens on a deep urban problem in the United States, with Baltimore being probably the best, most emblematic case of just something that's distinctly and deeply wrong going on.
And, of course, you can't dismiss it just as racial tension between a white power structure and black citizens, because the mayor, the city council, the police commissioner, the state prosecutor, all are African American. You know, John, it's been 3 years since Trayvon Martin was killed in Florida. And I just feel like since in the past 3 years, we've had case after case of unarmed African American men dying in police custody or in encounters with the police. This, I guess, isn't new. Maybe it's the cameras that make it different.
Well, the cameras. Yeah, everybody is now a video crew and can be. And this is one of the great debates at the heart of this, which is members of the African American community say, yeah, everybody's just paying attention now to something we've been screaming about for years. And it's just people are just paying attention now because of the cameras. These are not aberrations that are being captured, but the lived experience of a lot of people in these communities that are just happen to be now finally captured by the cameras.
You know, we've also just learned, I think, so much about the pettiness of the things that are the triggering events of these kinds of things. So we had, in the case of Michael Brown, a routine shoplifting case where he stole some cigars or whatever he took. And in the Walter Scott case in North Charleston, he was pulled over for alleged stolen car, but he really fled because of child support payments. And then in the Freddie Gray case, it's still unclear exactly why they were meddling with him in the first place, but he evidently had a knife of some kind. So a man dies in custody, the police custody, because of possession of a switchblade. I mean, this is the kind of thing that people complain about, blacks complain about all the time, that they're just basically being harassed, and then harassment can become this kind of lethal outcome.
You know, the other thing is, if you go to Baltimore, and there are neighbors here, and we go all the time, it is the quintessential example of a city that once was a thriving, manufacturing, also a port city. And now, when you go, they've built up the harbor, and that's lovely. But you drive through that city, it's not that big. And half of it looks boarded up. People are standing on the street corners looking, just hanging out, looking like they're probably drunk. And with nothing to do, it is sort of the scene when you drive through the city. If you're going to Johns Hopkins for something and you drive through that city, it is reminiscent of what townships looked like during apartheid in South Africa. It's not a pretty sight.
You know, let's talk a little about the political repercussions of this. John, starting with the new attorney general, Laurentius, sworn in last week. Does this now become the top of her agenda?
It does, because she has to manage this and the federal and the civil rights investigation into it, but also because there's going to be another one of these, either because the cameras are prevalent, or I talked to Elijah Cummings, the congressman who represents this area of Baltimore, and when he was talking about this, it's not just the relationship between the communities and the police. It's the feeling in the African-American communities that has all kinds of different facets to it. I mean, you know, if you look at the life of Freddie Gray, won a judgment because there was poison levels of lead in his house. Mm-hmm. His mother, according to the Washington Post, was on heroin and he was 4 years behind in the reading level when he was in school. And when you talk to Congressman Cummings, these are the other issues that, you know, we talked about the baseball game that was delayed and then played without an audience. You know, Camden Yards is kind of a monument to the inequality here between the people who can go to the game and the people who then live around it, who may never have ever been to a baseball game because they can't afford to be in a baseball game. And then so it gets to the inequality in American life as well. So all of those mushrooming issues are going to create another instance in which Loretta Lynch has to deal with what is a particularity of a specific community in this case, or these kinds of issues that are going to come up in other
communities. This was one of her priorities already. She had said that. But and she sent, it's interesting, she sent emissaries to Baltimore, both to the African-American community and to the cops, to say, you know, I'm not going to, she doesn't want to get to be in this adversarial, she wants to do what Holder did without being quite so confrontational.
And this is the kind of thing that starts to scramble a lot of wider politics, too. I mean, you take, you know, Jeb Bush started to jump in and said this points to the deficiencies in our welfare system, we need to change the education system, et cetera. And then you have somebody like Rand Paul, which is a rather extraordinary moment where here's a person that got into the race. He very much has tried to found himself as like a conservative that really cares about issues of the inner city, about sentencing reform. And then he says on a radio show that he was on an Amtrak train going through Baltimore, and good thing it didn't stop there. I mean, really a kind of an amazing moment.
And of course, this is a man who has made some efforts to reach out to African-American voters for Republicans. He has since suggested that that was a mistake for him to have made that comment. We're going to take a short break. We have a lot of listeners in Baltimore, and we're sending our best wishes to them for a peaceful weekend. We'll be back in a few minutes. We'll talk about that big Supreme Court argument on same-sex marriage. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from A24, presenting Ex Machina, a new artificial intelligence thriller from Alex Garland, the writer of 28 Days Later and Sunshine. Ex Machina, now playing everywhere. From Athena Health, cloud-based EHR and practice management services for medical groups and health systems to help physicians work as one across the continuum of care. More at athenahealth.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. On our Friday News Roundup, in the studio with me, Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Neil King, Jr., he's global economics editor and deputy Washington bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. And John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine and political director of CBS News, set to take over the reins of CBS's Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer. He'll begin that new gig in June. We hope to take some phone calls. We're having a little trouble with the phones, so you might want to shoot us an email, drshow@wamu.org, or post a comment on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll hope to be able to take some phone calls later in this hour. Well, Nina, you were there in the court during these arguments on whether there is a constitutional right to marry. Just tell us what the scene was like.
Well, it was not as tense, oddly enough, as the Obamacare case. But the place was packed. People had been sleeping outside for days since the weekend, since Friday, for a Tuesday argument. Even people who, and I saw a deputy assistant attorney general in the bar line. She had slept overnight to get in. So it was quite an amazing scene. And the plaza on one side, there were Hasidic Jews praying, and on another side there were rainbow flags, and inside was this very spirited, somber argument broken up by a protester who started shouting that if you support gay marriage, you'll burn in hell. And it turns out he's done this before at the Supreme Court in an abortion case. We didn't know that at the time. But he was such a loud screamer that we could hear him for like 2 minutes as the argument resumed. So it was quite, it was 2.5 hour argument. And it was one of those really extraordinary historic moments in which, if you knew nothing else, you wouldn't know how this is going to turn out. You wouldn't have any guesses at all.
But, you know, the guesses beforehand have been that the direction the court's moving, the direction that American society is moving, is toward a recognition of marriage as a constitutional right. Do you think that is the likely outcome, or are you not sure?
Well, the only reason I think it's, you know, if you were a betting person, it, as I said, based on what you heard, you wouldn't bet a nickel. But they had four courts of appeals strike down constitutional amendments and laws all over the country in something like 15 or 20 states, and they left those in place. And those are final judgments. That means those constitutional amendments and those laws don't exist anymore. In law talk, they don't exist anymore. And I don't. You can't just say, oh, we'll put them back now. You'd have to readopt them. It would be, in some states that would be easy, in other states it wouldn't. You just assume that when a court leaves a final judgment, it means to do what it did.
Think how disruptive it will be if the court does not recognize a constitutional right, and you have lots of same-sex couples that have now gotten married or planned weddings. I mean, this change we've seen in American public opinion, John, has been pretty stunning.
It has been stunning, and so, and that's right. This would change a lot of, or reverse a lot that's already happened. And the question is whether the court can push back against that fast-moving tide. I was fascinated by this theory, and Nina, you can tell me if this is nuts or the John Roberts raised the notion of gender discrimination being a possible problem here, which is to say, if a man can marry a woman, then it's discrimination if a woman can't marry a woman. And the theory, as it was explained to me by one court watcher, was that the reason he might go this route is so that he could support a majority on his own grounds that would be more than just another 5-4 decision, because he wants larger decisions than just 5-4 for something that's this big.
It's a theory.
We'll find out soon. When do we expect a decision?
Probably the last day of the term in late June would be my guess, or the second to last day.
Justice Alito seemed to be suggesting there was a compromise possible, which would be to require states to recognize same-sex marriages that take place in other states, but not to necessarily allow them in their own states. Did that seem to get any traction?
There wasn't much discussion of it beyond his suggestion. You almost, it's a different version of the same thing. I'm looking for a way that maybe we could, or I don't have to be. I mean, this is a big legacy case. Let's face it. Do you want to be, from the point of view of the plaintiffs in this case, do you want to be on the wrong side of history? If you look at the polls, it's the wrong side of history. So, these people are not immune to that idea, I think. But most of the argument was really fairly straightforward. It was about these places voted for this. Who are we to tell, that this is from millennia, this has been the law. Who are we to tell them that after 10 or 15 years that the millennia were wrong?
Yeah, I'm surprised a little bit as a betting man on your, I wouldn't bet a nickel, because I would bet several hundred dollars that it will that they will go in favor of
I have done
marriage.
Very well in life by not predicting what the Supreme Court would do.
That's why I don't cover it. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the two people that will tip this, John Roberts or Anthony Kennedy, both of them were saying things that, as John was pointing out, that would give them room. Kennedy talked a lot about this whole fact that marriage bestows dignity. Mm-hmm. Dignity was sort of the key word that came up many times. And it seemed somewhat clear, I thought, that though he might have his reservations, he was more of the mind of allowing people of the same sex to have that dignity than not. But maybe.
I thought he held his public cards pretty close to the vest, and the Chief Justice asked almost no friendly questions to gay marriage except that one.
Neil, you know, we've had other news this week on the economy that didn't seem good. I mean, we've had this recovery, but it hasn't really helped everybody in American society. Some disappointing numbers out this week. What did you see?
Well, we have a first quarter problem. Every year, it seems, for a while now, the first quarter of the year starts off bad. And we have reasons. There are always sort of one-off reasons. We had a bad winter. There was a pretty prolonged port strike on the West Coast that hit exports and imports. The dollar was a big factor, rising oil prices. So what we saw was exports were down, business investment was down. Overall, the economy barely grew at all by just a tiny bit above zero. We saw this last year, almost the exact same number. The big shock last year was that when they went back and revised the numbers, we had then a really sharp drop in economic output in the first quarter. The debate now is whether we'll really see something like that. I kind of think we won't. And there's generally a sense, you know, the Fed then met on Wednesday and talked and said that these were all transitory effects and really expects that, like we saw last year, that the economy will pick up again and that we'll see something like 2-2.5% growth this year. The thing, though, as you highlighted, is that's just not quite what we're used to and isn't really quite enough to lift wages in the way that we want to see, or to even get inflation up to where the Fed would like to see it, which is more like 2%. It's been kind of hovering around 1% for a long time.
It's like this recovery over the last 6 years is sort of a self-hating recovery. Once it gets kind of some momentum and starts feeling, you know, like things are moving, 300,000 jobs a month, the clip is going on, then it suddenly gets sort of has a bout of self-doubt in that first quarter.
That
and then, right,
good,
exactly.
Well, all Americans are encouraging the economy to hold on. Let's try the phones. We'll go to Curtis, who's calling us from New York City. Curtis, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Susan, and hi, panel. I wanted to basically, I was kind of, normally I'm very happy with the press, especially NPR, WANU, and you know, and John, you're doing great. Congratulations on your new promotion. But I'm just kind of disappointed in this idea of, you know, the guy from Baltimore. Basically, it seems like the story is being kind of swallowed whole. And the problem for me is that the police, the story keeps changing. First, he threw himself around in the back. Then it was a rough ride. Now he's had a switchblade. Like, the story keeps changing. And and it's not like we don't have evidence that police lie. Like, we have the Walter Scott case where the police report is totally at odds with the video. And the second question I have, actually, is, John Engelis, the vice president, executive vice president of the Orioles, made a very prescient point, and he just basically said, with the outsourcing of jobs, what you have, and with the outsourcing of factories, he said, what you have is basically this floating population, and you have unrest. And it was a huge point. Like, I mean, it went above and beyond anything I've ever seen. And I wanted to know if you were familiar with his comments, and it flies directly in the face of the arguments for NAFTA and TPP and free trade. And he's tying these two disparate events and all of this civil unrest together. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
All right, Curtis, thank you so much for your call. Neil King.
No, it's a fabulous and a very interesting point. I mean, Baltimore is emblematic of so much that's occurred in the United States. I mean, it was a once vibrant port city. There was a lot of companies that were based there, manufacturing jobs. You look at the housing stock of where all these people live, where we were, you know, where the press was so heavily roaming the streets over the last few days. Those are very nice houses. They were built in a different time of a sort of solid middle, lower middle class where people could make certain wages. And the globalization, the forces of globalization, of automation, of a variety of things, has really hollowed out places like that. And the statistics, which we've all seen in abundance this week, are really shocking. The education levels, the unemployment rate is about 50% in the core area where Freddie Gray was from. So those forces are very vibrant there. And it's, you know, we all talk about income inequality. This is sort of the poster child for income inequality, a city like Baltimore.
Now, Curtis, you raised the issue of whether the police are not being held accountable. I would just say that I think we're waiting for more information. You know, we haven't seen the police report. We haven't seen the coroner's report. I think that there is an inclination to hold the police accountable once we know more. We have a kind of related email making a similar point from Dan, who's writing us from Sacramento, and he wrote us, it's easy to blame the citizens for the rioting, but the real persons responsible for the damages done are the police officers who caused the injuries that led to Mr. Gray's death. The citizens were not waiting for another black man to die under suspicious circumstances, just the opposite. And the police, true to form, are withholding information to protect themselves. John, what do you think?
Well, this is the balance that, I mean, lots of people would look at this and say there, you know, there are laws in place that essentially protect the police in these instances. And then there's a culture in place that protects the police. And so what we're trying to, and that's why there's a push for the cameras, both because it's been so effective in bringing these cases to light where, and the North Charleston case is the most bleak, although we may find bleakness in this one as well. We only know part of the story. But where the official story was so at odds with reality and contained so much of that sort of language that seemed pattern language. The police officer felt threatened. Then we saw in the video he wasn't threatened. So we're trying to find, this is about these specific instances, but it's also about finding whatever the new balance is. And there are some police who are anxious to have the cameras because they want to be on record now in a state of heightened scrutiny of the police. They want footage so that they can say, I was doing the right thing. Proof, because now the burden of proof is now on them to prove that they were.
You know, the language we all use in this case also matters. I heard a piece on NPR this morning on Morning Edition that talked about whether you should call them riots or rebellions. When President Obama referred to some of the people doing looting as thugs, the White House got a lot of questions about whether that was an appropriate word to use. Nina, how much difference does the language that we journalists use make in a case like this?
Well, I suppose it does, but I don't see that people who are setting fires and breaking windows and looting stores, that you can call it a rebellion. That's a stretch for me. You can have terrible wrongs at the same time that you have a reaction that's inappropriate, let's put it that way. I mean, I read a story that even some of the gang members were helping to sort of calm things down. And Steve Inskeep, from NPR, the host of Morning Edition, had this wonderful piece where he went to Baltimore and he was talking to a guy whose store had just been looted. Everybody on the street was taking care of him, boarding it up while the Rite Aid was being still looted.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. And we are able to take some phone calls, which is great. Let's talk to Mark. He's calling us from Dallas, Texas. Mark, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me. I hope I'm not a little premature because I was hoping to bring up Bernie Sanders' intro into the presidential race and maybe shoot a shot across the bow of the panel because I thought...
Mark, are you still there?
Mark.
Mark, I'm sorry, your call has somehow been dropped, not by us, because we're
right.
Eager.
Yes. It's not
talk.
A conspiracy, honestly.
We're eager to talk about Bernie Sanders. He entered the president. I've got to say, this is an unlikely presidential contender in some ways. 73 years old. He's not a Democrat. He calls himself a Democratic Socialist. He says he's not going to become a Democrat for the purposes of this race, except in states where he has to do so. And yet, I agree with Mark that this is a candidacy we should take seriously, John.
That's right. One of my greatest, one of my favorite descriptions of him written by one of my favorite political journalists was his chaotic halo of thinning white hair. Susan, in your piece about him, it's true. There's a lot stacked against him, including the fact that he's running to Hillary Clinton's left, which is a very small portion of the Democratic Party, smaller portion in the Democratic Party than conservatives are in the Republican Party. Hillary Clinton polls very well among liberals. In fact, in many polls, does better among liberals than she does with other kinds of Democrats. However, in a coronation, which is essentially what the Democratic nomination process looks like right now, all the more reason, both if you are of no party and also for a lot of Democrats I talk to have a vigorous fight over the issues and a debate about what the Democratic Party believes. And Bernie Sanders is promising to run that kind of a campaign. He has not actually taken on Hillary Clinton, but he has a lot of things that he could debate with her, and it'll be interesting to see when he engages. And part of this may be the media's fault for not, you know, for caring only about the horse race and by that measure thinking Clinton is going to walk away with it. But it's also there's a challenge for the senator, which is to point out the places where he is different from Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton says she wants to be the people's champion. Well, that has been Bernie Sanders's entire career. So he has lots of things that he could point out where he is distinguished from Hillary Clinton and create a real battle of ideas, at least sort of in an academic sense, even if it doesn't change the state of the actual race.
His literature has, I think it says, the stamp at the bottom of the literature says, paid for by Bernard, something like that. And then it says in parens, not billionaires.
The billionaire class is something he talks about.
One of the great figures I saw looking over things this morning is that allegedly his net worth is between $150,000 and $500,000. And 500,000 happens to be the same number that Bill Clinton makes for a single speech. I look at him as a Ron Paul of this race, basically, the outsider of his of a party that he doesn't really belong to, who's going to take a lot of shots at the people in the middle.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll take your calls and questions, and we'll discuss some of the other big cases before the Supreme Court this week with Nina Totenberg and our other panelists. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online, with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. From Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Japan's Prime Minister urges Congress to support the Pacific Trade Pact. The U.S. Navy accompanies American flagged ships in the waters near Iran. And the death count in Nepal's earthquake surpasses 6,000. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. On the first hour of our news roundup, we're joined by Neil King of The Wall Street Journal, Nina Totenberg of NPR, John Dickerson of Slate and CBS. You can watch all of our guests on our live video stream. You can get that at drshow.org. Well, Nina, we talked about the big gay marriage case before the court, but there was another important case involving the constitutionality of drugs used in lethal injections. What is the issue here?
Well, the issue is that the drug cocktail that has been used since 1977 starts with a barbiturate, and the kind of anesthesia that you would get, sort of the kind of anesthesia that you would get when you have real surgery, and then you don't feel. The idea is you don't feel what would otherwise be very painful the next two drugs. Well, that drug has largely become unavailable. Drug manufacturers, pharmacists, doctors' organizations, for ethical reasons, they have withdrawn it. And that leaves the states, they have chosen another drug, which is not actually, it's not the same kind of drug. And so that was, the case was, is that enough? Or are these folks who are being put to death then suffering cruel and unusual punishment? And there have been three botched executions where people were writhing on the gurney for as much as 2 hours. And clearly, the court, there were two dramas in the court. One was the drama of the death penalty, and the other was the drama between the justices, the conservatives and liberals, and on this point, and it was the most ferocious argument I have perhaps ever been to, where they were really at each other's throats.
Because the debate was not just about the Eighth Amendment and cruel and unusual. It became, I think, as Scalia said, you know, he saw it as a guerrilla war to undermine the entire death penalty. The idea being that there is no way to not make the death penalty cruel and unusual. And therefore, if that's the case, then the whole thing must be taken away.
And I thought justices were always very courteous to one another on the bench. But in this case, Chief Justice Roberts actually chastised Justice Sotomayor for talking too much. Tell us about that.
Well, and she did, but she became so frustrated.
She did talk too much?
She probably did talk too much. And she and Kagan were so frustrated, and Sotomayor was even more frustrated, by the fact that there is science here about this drug and the way it works. I mean, Kagan called the lower court opinion gobbledygook. Breyer said there is zero data to support the expert witness who testified in this case. And Sotomayor was just pulling her hair out over the fact that there was so much wrong in the evidence, that it can't be, it scientifically can't be, that was being presented by the state of Oklahoma. She actually said to the lawyer for the state of Oklahoma, "I can't believe anything you say because you misrepresent these studies. I've read these studies." And so they were interrupting counsel like crazy, and at the end, without naming her, but clearly he meant her, the Chief Justice said to the lawyer for Oklahoma, he said, "Well, you know, this is an unusual situation where you've been doing more listening than talking, so I'm going to give you an extra 5 minutes, and of course we'll give the other side an extra 5 minutes."
Has this ever happened before in your experience?
No.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, Neil, it strikes me, on the death penalty, on same-sex marriage, on the Affordable Care Act, it is the Supreme Court that seems to be the most fully functioning branch of government, making decisions that are going to be really far-reaching.
It's true, and in ways that are very fascinating to watch, that are very dynamic, with basically Roberts and Kennedy being the people that everybody looks at to determine it. A lot, you know, they are themselves very wary about playing this role. I mean, in the same-sex marriage case in particular, they were like, "Why does this have to be on our doorstep?" On the conservative side in particular, there was, "Boy, we sure would rather leave this to the states to decide in the voting manner that they have. For millennia, we've been living one way. All of a sudden, we want to live another way." On the death penalty, I just want to point out one thing that is interesting that's going on more in the legislative arena is a real beginning of a pushback against the death penalty itself, and also on the conservative side. In Nebraska, the unicameral legislature there, I think it was this week, voted to abolish the death penalty. The governor is not very in favor of it, but there's a real movement afoot. It goes sort of to the Rand Paul, he's one of the ones that are supportive of this, on conservative front to get rid of something that they look at it from a slightly different point of view because it's so onerous to the entire system. These kinds of cases that make their
they
way to the Supreme
Court. They clog it up. It costs a huge amount of money. But, you know, one of the men who was the plaintiff in this case, one of the guys who was going to be executed and whose execution they stayed, you know, he had, as Justice Scalia pointed out, he had been sentenced to life in prison for killing someone. And while in prison, he killed a prison guard. That's why he got the death penalty.
We have some news from the Associated Press on Baltimore. The state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, says that the death of Freddie Gray has been ruled a homicide. She says they have probable cause to press charges. Also, the police union has asked the state's attorney to appoint a special independent prosecutor in that case. We'll be following that closely. Let's go to a caller who wants to talk, I think, about this case. Robert, who's calling us from North Carolina, from Charlotte. Robert, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a surgeon, head and neck surgeon, and I've had 30, 35 years of experience with trauma. And it was obvious that when Mr. Gray was thrown into the back of the van, he already had a broken neck. You know, they have a video showing a guy popping him in the back, kneeing him in the back. And there's kind of a weak spot between the cervical and the thoracic vertebra. And when they pick him up, he looks like his legs are spaghetti, and he's grimacing in pain, and it's obvious that he's already injured, and he couldn't move anything, you know, below the waist. They're dragging him along. Now you restrain him, a guy with a broken neck, toss him unbuckled into the back of a van and bounce him around for 30, 40 minutes, and you end up with a severed spinal column, which is a really unusual injury. You know, you have to... He would already have had to have some injury before that. So I think it's obvious what happened. He was taken down, they broke his neck, and then tossed him in the back of the van and polished him off.
All right, Robert, thanks so much for your call and your analysis. One of the great things about the Diane Rehm Show is the callers you get who have incredible expertise, like in a physician like yourself. Thanks so much for giving us a call. We've gotten several emails directed at you, Nina, and a comment that you made earlier. I'll just read one of them from W. Middleton, who's writing us from Ohio. This person writes, I am troubled by the poor choice of words in describing citizens of Baltimore. To say that people are just standing around looking drunk is insulting and in many ways capture a racist portrayal of communities of color. What would you say, Nina?
Well, I didn't have in mind any particular race. What I had in mind was people who obviously have no job, nothing to do, are standing on the corner, not fully functional. Perhaps I should have said not fully functional. And that is the saddest thing in a country that prides itself on the ability to as a working country.
We just talked to Robert, who brought us the expertise of a physician to our conversation. Let's go to Craig, who's calling us from Pasadena, Texas. Craig, I gather you're a former police person, police officer.
I was a former police officer. I actually went after corruption and ended up in federal court myself and was looking at going to jail for 20-something years. And I was fighting, and actually I'm very nervous to even talk about that now because a lot of the people that I went after, somehow or another, even with some of the evidence that I had on them, maintained positions of authority, and they have them today. So I won't go too far into that because that's not far from where I live. But what I will say is... I understand that police officers can be very questionable in their activities, but what do we do with these criminals? Do we just let them run from us? What we need to do is train police officers to be probably better communicators, but when we're dealing with habitual criminals, where's the answer? 14, 15, 15, 20, 30 arrests? I had to deal with people like that. You get tired of it, and nothing seems to get done. Now, that's one thing I'll say. Now, let's talk about something, and I want all your opinion on this. Education is the problem. I tell my own daughter right now, go to school, study hard, because you're going to have to take care of the people who sit in school all day and do nothing. Now,
okay, Craig, thanks so much for your call. Nina.
Well, police departments have rules about this, and unless you're a danger to yourself or the police officer or other people, if you run... Yeah, the police can run and catch up with you, but if they can't catch up with you, they can't just shoot you. That's not considered. And even if you had a switchblade that they took away from you, I mean, it's not a capital offense.
You know, Neil, this case has focused some attention on Martin O'Malley, who has been expressed some interest in running for the Democratic nomination, former governor of Maryland and also mayor of Baltimore, and some of the practices that he had the police force use while he was mayor. Tell us about that.
You know, for a lot of listeners, I'm sure that there are a lot of fans of The Wire out there, and though The Wire was anything but a documentary, the great HBO series by David Simon, it all the same was based loosely on Martin O'Malley's time as mayor. And you know, Martin O'Malley was a strong purveyor of a kind of aggressive policing, broken windows strategy that was big at the time to go after this kind of urban decay and urban criminality that was really a problem, particularly in Baltimore. So it was extremely aggressive, arresting a lot of people without probable cause, cracking down, sort of speaking of corners, they would basically come and just grab people off of the famous corners of Baltimore. And he used that, both that he was strong on policing and look at how the crime rate went down, to launch his gubernatorial campaign, and he became the governor. And, you know, depending on how you look at it, a fairly successful one. He's now looking at running in 2016. This complicates, to say the least, his narrative, because speaking of David Simon, he had a really savage interview this week where he was basically accusing O'Malley of being the heart of the problem that we're now seeing manifest in Baltimore. And then O'Malley came out and gave an interview to the New York Times where he said he engaged in no aggressive policing at all. But, you know, will he run? Will he get a foothold? He's a long shot, to say the least. But part of his story, his rise was, I became mayor of this city, a troubled city. I made it a better city. I became governor, and then I did all these other things for the entire state of Maryland. I think it makes it more difficult.
The policy conflict here is, on the one hand, the Martin O'Malley view was, if you arrest people for doing the small things, the broken window ideas, if there are no broken windows, it doesn't lead to a kind of mushrooming of violence and bad behavior. So get it, sort of nip the violence in the butt. What we're hearing now from a lot of these communities, though, is that approach encased people in this sense of violence and confrontation that was like a pressure cooker that's now exploding.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a caller, Kathy, who takes me to account because I mentioned Trayvon Martin. She notes, why is he always brought up? He wasn't killed by police. That's true, and I apologize for that error. He was not killed by police. That's not an example of that. You know, one of the people, when we're talking about 2016, who's been affected by this development is Hillary Clinton, who has talked in a way that really seems to distance herself from the 1994 crime bill that her husband signed as president. That was a kind of a tough-on-crime bill. She's now said in a big speech, really her first serious policy speech since she announced her candidacy, that we have to end the era of mass incarceration.
You know, this is the numbers of people who are incarcerated in this country is staggering. And it affects their lives forever after. Even if they're only there for 30 days, it follows them forever in terms of their employment. But we do have to recognize that in the late 1980s and 1990s, the crack epidemic was just scaring people to death because it was ravaging communities, absolutely ravaging them. And starting in the Reagan and first Bush administration, the first President Bush administration, the idea was lock people up for a very long time, even if they have a relatively minor role, and get these people off the streets so that we can just tamp this down and get this under control. Well, it just didn't, you know, you could say that it worked. It worked for a while, but then it didn't work anymore. And the crack epidemic, for reasons that I've never been able to ascertain, it seemed to fade out of its own accord to some extent. Maybe people who took drugs decided that this was just going to kill them and that was a crazy thing to do. I'm not quite sure. But it went away as a huge epidemic. It was about it was less than a 10-year terror.
Yeah. This is an interesting example of, I think, a bunch of cases where we're going to see Hillary having to run against Bill, basically. I mean, you see here President Obama is championing this big Pacific trade deal. He's pointing at NAFTA, saying we want to avoid above all the ills of NAFTA. Hillary Clinton isn't even willing to endorse the Pacific trade deal, much less defend the sort of trade deal that her own husband championed. Of course, you know, there was the Defense of Marriage Act that Bill Clinton also signed. I guess in part it highlights how dramatically long ago and different that time was. Mm-hmm. There are just so many issues that we've just moved on.
But I'm told that she actually opposed doing the NAFTA fight when they did it. So even back then, she had doubts about NAFTA, or certainly spending a lot of chits on it.
The what's interesting also, just from a political standpoint, is that she rushed to the microphones to offer a policy solution to a burning issue. We talked earlier about some of the difficulty Republican candidates had with coming up with the words of the moment. And our presidential campaigns are rightly derided. But this was, and particularly the way that Hillary Clinton has been basically running from behind bulletproof bulletproof glass so far since announcing her presidency, unavailable to the press, not really saying anything that would cause any kind of mild abrasions. But this was an attempt to actually offer a policy solution to a thing that was happening in the moment, which is a real difference in the way she's run her campaign.
And, you know, she'd much rather talk about that than talk about the fundraising for the Clinton Foundation,
much
which is the subject
talk
of
about that.
Stories, a variety of stories that raise questions about whether foreign governments and businesses tried to curry favor with her as Secretary of State by contributing to the Clinton Foundation. Is this a real scandal, Neil, do you think, or is it just something that her opponents have cooked up?
Whether it really is a scandal or whether it just feels like a scandal is the question, I suppose. But for most people, most voters, they see these things out of the corner of their eye, and if it feels bad, if it has that sense of impropriety about it, which this distinctly does, that in itself can be very damaging, particularly as it continues to drip and roll forward. And, you know, the New York Times and others have these incredible stories about the whole uranium thing that the Clinton Foundation was, or Bill Clinton was sort of part of. And so it's difficult. It'll go on and on for her.
And we'll just close with breaking news from the Associated Press. The state's attorney has charged all six officers in Freddie Gray's police custody, charges against them in the death of Freddie Gray. Well, that's all the time we have for the first hour of our news roundup. We're glad to be joined this hour by Nina Totenberg of NPR, Neil King Jr. of The Wall Street Journal, John Dickerson of Slate and CBS. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.